You're listening to Talking Joe, and today we will be talking G.I. Joe, A Real American Hero, 305. Spoilers ahead as normal. But before we get started, here's a few words from Serpento Khan.
Greetings.
Great Serpento changed my life. Great Serpento made me do good. If you want to win in a zombie fight, you must listen to what Serpento said.
Eat some flesh, ignore your sores.
Hail a great Serpento.
Only breathe mutant spores.
Hail a great Serpento.
And if you want to rule all that you survey, you must listen to what the great Serpento say.
Accept no resistance from the Cobra base.
Hail a great Serpento.
Let's eat up the United States.
Hail a great Serpento.
And if you want to make your enemies pay, you must listen to what the great Serpento say.
G-R-E-A-T-S-E-R-P-E-N-T-O-R.
Great Serpento.
Hey, 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 it's me, Mark, and welcome to Talking Joe, the G.I. Joe Comics podcast. If you're new to the show, you can find out all of the details over at the website, which is talkingjoe.co.uk. And joining me, as always, to talk about comics, it's a real American baked potato. It's Tim Finn. How are you, sir?
I'm well, Mark, and hello, listeners.
Tim, now a couple of questions for you. The parody song opening the show today is inspired by Thank You, Baked Potato by Matt Lucas, an English comedian. It was very big over here during lockdown times. I'm assuming that it probably didn't make it over your side of the shore.
I'm not the best arbiter of pop music or meme music. So it's possible there are a lot of Americans who know this song and we would be having a different conversation with you.
And what about the concept of jacket potatoes or baked potatoes? How big on a dietary scale are they over in the States?
I think moderate. I feel like in the 80s, the baked potato was a thing. Although, you know, in 2024, I have seen a TV ad campaign for Idaho potatoes as opposed to potatoes from anywhere else. I feel like in the 80s, I would see TV commercials for chain restaurants that, you know, where the baked potato was a part of your delicious steak dinner. And maybe I'm watching different TV, or maybe the American diet has rotated a little bit away from potato. You know, in the 90s and aughts, people talked a lot about carbs. Now they're talking about carbs again, differently, the same.
Yeah, I'd say over in the UK, it's like a sort of a national icon dish. Like, if you're just looking for something quick to eat, you're probably going to look in the fridge or your pantry and find some jacket potatoes there, stick them in the microwave for 10 minutes, or maybe in the oven if you're feeling fancy, you know, put on some baked beans on top and, you know, bish, bosh, bash, there's a quick and tasty meal for you. Right, but this isn't the Jacket Potato podcast. This is Talking Joe, and today we are looking at G.I. Joe, A Real American Hero, issue 305, which was released on the 20th of March, 2024. Before we get too far into looking at the issue itself, we can catch up on some news.
Hot and ho! Pathetic.
Some general G.I. Joe news of interest is that we're going to begin seeing some of the trade paperbacks of these things coming out. So Void Rivals Volume 1 has been out, and Duke and Cobra Commander Volume 1 will be out in June. So if you're one of those people that reads these things or collects as a trade paperback format, you know, you're beginning to get involved in having something tangible in your mitts up front as well. A bit of the news that sort of slightly surprised me, because, you know, maybe I don't necessarily get so many of the thin trade paperbacks these days was that the Void Rivals trade paperback seemed very slim on bonus content, Tim.
We have this at my store. It's been out for a week or two. Funnily enough, I haven't actually picked it up and flipped through it, and I tend to do that with all the new books. But I do think back to the Walking Dead softcover collections, which did, to my recollection, do not include the covers. And there was a book of the first, I don't know, 100 or so, or, you know, 150 Walking Dead covers as a separate collection. And I thought, if that's what's happening here with the Energon universe, I don't know that there's going to be a separate book with covers or all the variant covers, but there is some precedent in the Skybound publishing universe. My preference is a collection should include the covers. I think they should be included as chapter breaks, not all at the end, unless something about the storytelling really suggests that. And The Walking Dead actually does work like this on purpose, where the last page of an issue runs right into the first page of the next issue. And as a reading experience, maybe you, quote, should read all six issues together in a row without chapter breaks.
Right. And I think they're probably going to follow that publishing model as well, where they'll release, you know, relatively cheap and straightforward floppy trade paperbacks, and then follow that up with a hardcover deluxe, which will sort of have all of the bells and whistles. So maybe, you know, more comprehensive set of covers, sketches, interviews, commentary, that kind of thing.
Yeah. With Skybound, there are the slim, you know, six issue at a time paperbacks, and there are the compendia, 48 or so issues at a time, and big, big fat paperbacks. Skybound also publishes for Walking Dead and Invincible bigger hardcovers that are, what is it?
About 20-something issues.
Yes, they're about 24 issues. And then also bigger slipcase deluxe hardcovers. And so there's the whole range of formats. I feel like there's sort of this unspoken, old-fashioned thinking from the late 80s and early 90s when Marvel and DC were starting to, were figuring out how they wanted to approach trade paperback collections for comic book stores and the bookstore market. You know, the first printings of any Marvel collections, you know, in the Fireside books in the 60s and 70s, Origins of Marvel Comics, Son of Origins, the actual first like Marvel collections, Dark Phoenix Saga, From the Ashes, Iron Man, Demon in a Bottle. Those did not include the covers.
Oh.
And sometimes I've got the first printing of what is it? Is it Origin of the Hobgoblin? It's got a Derek Yeniger cover of the Hobgoblin's face. And Marvel on some of the early collections would actually strip the credits from the first or second page of each issue. So there wouldn't be a box with, you know, writer, penciler, inker, letterer, colorist, because they, you know, they were trying to sort of get away from this format, like it had been a monthly serial, sort of like the difference between watching an episode of the G.I. Joe cartoon on TV where there's an ad break, or watching it on VHS where there are no ad breaks, or nowadays watching it on Hasbro's YouTube channel and there aren't ad breaks, but the bumpers that go to and come back from commercial are still there. And so there is this admission that it was a format with a particular setup. You have a break every 7 minutes. And so I feel like these comic books are published as 20-page increments with dazzling marquee cover art. And I don't think the paperbacks should run away from that.
Interesting. Next topic is around Paul Pelletier. So he was announced as the fill-in artist for 306. We've seen a cover for 307 where he's credited as the artist there. And he's also been doing sketches at conventions. So, for example, Greg from Anything Joe's podcast saw him at Lexington Comic Con, and he did him a lovely looking Scarlet sketch, and I've seen a Zartan sketch, and he's also done a couple on his own website where he's been sort of putting those up for sale, so that he's done a Snake Eyes, a Baroness, a Destro, and he also did one for Diana Davis, Duke, more Duke. So very much getting into the G.I. Joe vibe, and it sounds like he will be doing more than just the one issue, potentially the next arc or so, which is, interesting. And I think in terms of having, you know, talking about trade paperbacks again, if we're sort of looking at five issue arcs for a trade, having that consistency of artist is always welcome.
Jumping to the first bit of the letters page of issue 305, the editor, Alex Antone, says, "We're working on a very top secret G.I. Joe project right now. It's launching this summer, ... And then two paragraphs down, hats off to Chris Mooneyham for finishing his fifth issue in a row, which I think is a lovely thing to say, but that also feels very modern. Like, man, artists sure can't do, but can barely hold on and do more than three or four issues in a row. And here's our guy who did five. I think what he's actually saying is this is a hard book to draw and we're giving him a hard time. And then I can't say enough good things about the energy that Chris has brought to this book. His next assignment is helping out with that top secret project, and then we're leaping him ahead for a new arc of a real American hero.
You know, he's been given a bit of, I think, a pause to let him let the deadlines catch up, but then he's moving across to a top secret project for a bit before coming back to a new arc for ARAR. So whether that's 5 issues time or 10 issues time, TBC. But a top secret project, I'm sure, gave you all sorts of tingles, Tim.
Yeah, if I had to guess, it's a one-shot, a series of one-shots, which might be a yearbook or an annual, or or a mini-series. And I feel like what's being implied here is that Mooneyham starts to fall behind doing 20 pages a month, which is totally reasonable. This is a very hard book to draw. And you know, we're long past the era where sort of every artist is expected to be able to do a monthly book for a year or two. You know, nowadays, artists sign on for 5 or 6 issue arcs, and then sometimes they come back after the next arc. So this seems perfectly in keeping with that, you know, DC, Marvel. So I think the idea here is that whatever he's doing, a miniseries, a special, a one-shot, is going to be, you know, one issue or 4 issues worth of material, but he will have more than 1 month to do the one issue or more than 4 months to do the 4 issues so that he doesn't fall behind on this other thing. And then if Paul Pelletier is doing maybe 5 issues, like, okay, then right when he finishes this other thing, Mooneyham can come back and pick up. I think that's the idea. And I had thought that Pelletier would be doing a single fill-in, or maybe a fill-in and then Mooneyham and then another fill-in. And I thought, well, that feels very much like the Marvel 80s Joe, where, you know, Ron Wagner does 2 issues and then Marshall Rogers does an issue and then Ron Wagner's doing an issue and then, you know, Jeff Isherwood does an issue and then Ron Wagner does 2 issues or, you know, something like that. And some of them are pencils and some of them are breakdowns. This is one of these books that, you know, different than a lot of sort of arc-driven comics in the modern era. This is just month in, month out, grind, grind, grind. And as much as I'd like to have one artist draw, you know, 10 issues in a row, it's okay with me if someone draws 3 issues and then misses an issue and then draws 2 issues and then misses 3 issues and then draws 5 issues, as long as the other people are good. Ideally, they all sort of stylistically fit. But if it is going to be sort of a cleaner break, Mooneyham is on for 5 issues, off for 5 issues, and potentially back on for 5 issues. That is really tidy, and I appreciate that. Not just from a scheduling point of view, but from a, you know, reader and reader experience point of view. And it, you know, makes the, as you said, the volume 1 and volume 2 and volume 3 of the softcover collections just sort of fit that much better.
Yeah. And as well, this sort of secret project sort of gives us a bit of room to speculate about what potentially it could be. I like that thought that maybe it's a fancy yearbook. My guess is some sort of mini. But
I don't think it's the main book going bi-weekly, that's for sure.
No, but maybe something set in the past of G.I. Joe, like something connected to the LLRP, or maybe just like year zero of G.I. Joe, something like that. Or
I sort of think something like that might be coming a little later, and that initially there's going to be this is a feeling based on nothing. It's just a feeling. I sort of feel like in the second year there may be some flashback publication, and before then there may be some sort of untold tales or like character, you know, it's like a Molto special, a Black Hat special, a Sherlock special, something that Hama can write sort of more off the cuff. And since he has, you know, shown an interest in these new characters, and since maybe the new Skybound audience doesn't know these characters.
I like that speculation. I'm hoping for a little special which explains the story of Jeffrey the Techno Viper and how he escaped Cobra Island and the mutant zombie bomb, but we shall see.
I'm sort of wondering if he's on the cover to 305.
It could be.
Did he not just get away, but he really got away?
And other bit of news from this issue is that we're told that Brad Anderson is confirmed as a cover artist all the way through to issue 10. So expect a few more of those sort of spotlight covers with a Joe in the foreground and a Cobra in the background.
That is such a nice thing as a reader, and a reader who likes those covers, to read, because it just speaks to confidence and long-term planning and a sense of continuity. You know, like, you know, when Andy Kubert was announced as doing the cover to 301, and I think it was like covers by 301, I thought, oh, well, I'm sure they have them for 3 months, you know, and, you know, I couldn't dare to hope that he would be doing more covers than that. But, you know, I think some artists like to plan ahead and schedule. It's like, all right, I'm going to be doing X number of these for X number of months. And certainly editors like to, you know, line that stuff up. And, you know, if the talent is reliable, then it sort of all works out. But, you know, having Kubert and Walker really gives this series an identity. And that's great.
I had a thought about Kubert as a cover artist and his approach, but we'll talk about that maybe in a second when we start talking about the cover. So on to 305 details. It is brought to us by the creative team of writer Larry Hammer, artist Chris Mooneyham, completing his fifth issue in a row, colorist Francesco Segala with Sabrina Del Grosso as the flatter, letterer Pat Brousseau, editor Alex Antoni, publication design Gillian Crabb, production Richard Mercado, and creative consultant Diana Davis. Tim, let's have a look at the cover, shall we?
Let's have a look at the covers in the gallery.
Yeah, the cover to 305, Andy Kubert and Brad Anderson's main cover, cover A, is a bold, there's that word again, there's that Andy Kubert word, a bold shot of Cobra Commander full figure with his battle mask and a big flowing cape that's red on the inside, strutting right toward us at dusk, dramatic lighting behind him in Springfield with a "Welcome to Springfield, a nice little town" sign in the bit of compositional negative space below his cape. The Cobra Commander is flanked and followed by a legion of Vipers, Techno Vipers, and Televipers. And there's something really cool happening here where Kubert places the camera. So if you take Cobra Commander out of this cover, you realize that we're looking at a little bit of a downhill, a little bit of a decline with the road and the sidewalk. And if you look at Cobra Commander's feet, you realize that the road swoops down, and then at the very bottom of the cover, it is swooped up again at us. It is dipped and then raised. And so the camera is actually on the ground at, I don't know, a foot high, looking somewhat up at Cobra Commander. And yet, because the Viper, Techno Viper, and Televiper just behind Cobra Commander are lower than him, the camera is in effect at sort of waist height for them. So there's a very thoughtful and playful arrangement of characters, of blocking in the space here. And so you get, it's not a flat cover. It's not, you know, a bunch of cool cobras 1 foot in front of a wall or in front of no background or, you know, just in front of open sky. Kubert has all this space to carefully put some suburban houses, some suburban trees, some suburban mailboxes, and then additional Cobra troopers in those other negative spaces sort of around Cobra Commander's cape and arms. Brad Anderson does something interesting where all the reflected light on Cobra Commander, so the diagonal shadow across his chest made by his arm, the one that's out and then holding the staff, and then also the underside of that arm, and then also the knee and boot on his, on the right, on his left, all those reflected colors are purple. And even though I don't think of Cobra Commander as blue for his uniform as having any purple, by putting that blue into those shadow, excuse me, by putting those that purple into those shadow areas, Anderson is making Cobra Commander subtly agree with the Techno Viper and the Televiper, who do have that purple naturally in their costumes.
Hmm. Very good. I sort of had an observation about like the design of Cobra Commander here, because it looks a lot like the original V1 in many ways, in terms of like his belt with that kind of Illuminati triangle in a circle, Illuminati-esque triangles in a circle that he's got, that you don't always necessarily notice on the original figure because it's so small. But there's a big degree of like heft to him. He's got this cobra staff and he's got this black cloak with the red on the inside. And it sort of puts me in mind a little bit of some of the later Cobra Commander figures. There's a version 17 from 2004, which is kind of that, you know, Venom versus Valor era, where he's got a bit more of those sort of the cords on his tunic, and around about then he was being released more and more with a cape. I think some of those capes might have had been black with a red inside. I'm sure that it does exist in toy form. And again, around that time, he was being released more and more with a kind of serpent staff as well. So a bit of inspiration, I think, is being taken from that era. Funny enough, there was a Shipwreck that was released in 2003, which was, I think, part of Spy Troops, where he came with some Cobra Commander gear. He came with a black chrome helmet and a black cape as well. So it's almost parts of that costume that, and a staff, a gold serpent staff. So it's almost sort of cribbing from some of the that Cobra Commander era aesthetic. The other thing that sort of red cloak puts me slightly in mind is of that very famous painting of Napoleon on the horse.
Oh, there was a Cobra Commander variant cover.
Yeah, and there was a Cobra Commander variant cover that homaged that. Yeah, it's the it's called Napoleon Crossing the Alps, very famous classical painting by French artist Jacques Louis David in the early 1800s.
So in the Napoleon painting, the cape or the cloak is all red, whereas here it's the inside that's red. The way that in G.I. Joe, the movie, the animated movie, right at the beginning, Cobra Commander's black cape has red inside. There is a reference that this cover is making for sure. G.I. Joe 305 by Andy Kubert is referencing the cover to G.I. Joe 10.
Is that the Welcome to Springfield?
Yeah, where Scarlet and Snake Eyes are trotting through. I've always thought it was, I guess it's the road and not a driveway, but whatever it is, a path. And in the background is a suburban house and this same sign, or sign that says the same thing. And then in the foreground, behind a wood facade of a front of a house, are two Cobra soldiers with guns ready to sort of pop out and shoot Scarlet and Snake Eyes. And Scarlet is, I think, smiling in that cover.
Yeah.
So these two covers form a kind of bookend at the beginning and the current end of the G.I. Joe run. Something else that strikes me about this cover is that I'm not counting variant covers, but Cobra Commander hasn't actually appeared sort of big and front and center in all that many covers. He's front and center on Shannon Gallant's cover to issue 227. Where he's got his hands behind his head like he's relaxing or like he's under arrest. Destro and the Baroness are behind him, but there's sort of no background. There's just like a wall. You know, he's on the cover to 150 where he's fighting Snake Eyes. He's on the cover to 100, issue Marvel issue 100. I'm Back by Ron Wagner. And again, if you are a follower of variant covers, you might be able to rattle off, you know, 10 right now where, no, we've seen Cobra Commander, cool, pin-up-y, front and center, action pose, but not just in how it's drawn and composed, but also because it is Cobra Commander. We actually don't have a lot of G.I. Joe covers like this. You know, it's like, I think of a book like Batman, where 99% of the time, Batman is on the cover. And 80% of the time, he is a prominent element on that cover. You know, there are a couple of Batman covers where he's really small because it's actually about the villain or like Gotham City at night. Or, you know, there's a couple covers where Batman's just not there because it's like just a drawing of the Penguin's face, the Joker's face, or Robin, you know, or Robin and Alfred are in some danger in the Batcave or something. But just going by sort of normal A covers, as important as Cobra Commander is, this is kind of the first time we've seen a cover like this, quite like this.
Very good. Yeah, I was just having a flick through the Yo-Jo cover gallery while you were saying that. And yeah, certainly there's some iconic covers with him on. This is kind of unique to kind of this cover in terms of what's going on. And my other thought was, is this promising something to some degree that isn't quite happening in this issue? There's slightly less connection to the events of this issue from the cover than maybe some of the earlier ones. I mean, certainly Cobra Commander is gearing up to defend Springfield from Serpentor's invasion, but we don't get this sort of procession through the streets that's shown here. And I was sort of flicking ahead to 306 and 307, which is essentially a slightly more iconic solo image of Snake Eyes and then Destro. And I'm just wondering whether potentially the cover artist is having to work a little bit further ahead from the exact plot details that are being worked up by Larry Hama, that maybe he's be like, yeah, Snake Eyes is going to take a more important role. And we'll see him back in that visor costume. So you know, maybe do something of that. And yeah, we're introducing Destro back into the series, and he's going to be taking a more prominent role. So you know, do something with Destro, but you can keep it iconic because we don't exactly know the plot details yet at this stage.
I had thought the same thing. I think that's cool. I think it's okay. You know, this cover and the next two that are more pin-up-y and less story. But man, going back to the cover to 302 with the you know, Joe's holding a corpse, which manages to be both story-driven, representative of the issue, and also a compelling image. I would love to get back to that kind of cover. One last quick little bit. I did notice, as I'm sure other people did, that the Televiper is holding his video camera a little bit like a weapon. I'm okay with that because as a kid, I just pretended it was a big laser.
Yeah, it could be some sort of weapon, some sort of, like a beam weapon or something, but or it could just be that he's very aggressively, you know, recording what's going on. Funny enough, there was actually a bit of discussion on the Facebook group about this particular image, prompted by the question, why is the Televiper holding his camera like a gun? My initial reply was that he's visualizing going pew pew and shooting the things that he's recording. Bart said it's all radio waves. He can flip a switch and turn the camera gun into a microwave transmitter. Sorry, I'm a radio satcom guy. And Jay says that maybe he's Cobra Commander's nephew, Eugene, and he's always wanted to be a Viper, but his aim is worse than the Stormtrooper, so they handed him a camera instead, probably with no film in it. Paul says, to be fair, it does have a stock on the end of it, and that's used to rest against his shoulder, so it's a design feature. Thanks to all the contributions there.
And then the Techno Viper... his weapon, I think, is, I don't have an image of the classified Techno Viper in front of me. I'm thinking of the original action figure. Mm-hmm. His weapon does seem to be an actual Techno Viper's accessory, but proportioned quite differently to look more like a machine gun in its, a long gun in its shape, and mm-hmm. less like a welding, you know, device. And, you know, and similarly, like, I'm seeing some exaggerated or invented bits, I think, on some of these costumes. There's some ribbing on Cobra Commander's gloves. There's some, you know, ridges on the Viper. And I'm okay with this. I'm okay, you know, these costumes don't have to be, you know, they can be halfway between classified and the 80s figures. They can be halfway between those two with some invented stuff. You know, as long as they're hitting the high notes.
So we've got then the cover B, which is just the black and white version of this image. Then cover C is another one from Brad Walker. And this time it's two female characters, a woman, Dawn in the foreground and Baroness in the background.
There's a great bit of contrast here where Dawn is rushing to the left and the Baroness is rushing to the right, in addition to the warm yellow, orange, reds of the lower part of the cover and the cooler blues and purples of the top part of the cover. This is a pose on Don Marino. You tend not to see this pose on a lot of comic book covers, someone sprinting. But it's a very exciting dynamic cover.
Turning away from us and shooting, you do get boobs and butt, but it doesn't feel cheesecake, does it?
It doesn't feel cheesecake, and it also doesn't feel impossible. There are some artists who have been nicely called out on the internet.
Broken back poses.
Yeah, for doing that thing where you see so much of the butt and so much of the breasts that it feels exploitative rather than anatomical. And I don't get that sense here. Nothing about this cover seems sort of disproportionately sexy or showy if it were a man or two men on the cover from this cast of characters. It just looks like capable, cool hero, capable, cool villain, great costumes, great drawing, great color.
And then on retailer exclusives, we've got Mike Mayhew's web store variants continuing. He's now, I think, printing these on a thicker card stock because they were getting damaged in post. So this is the fifth one of those. This time it is Storm Shadow against a white background. And he has said that these have been doing very well for him, so he's looking to keep on going. So expect a few more. And then the final web store variant is Clayton Crane. And at the time of recording, we haven't yet seen that image. Last time around, I believe the image only came out a few days after release of, you know, the Wednesday release of the comic. So it might be that it's a few days after the actual, you know, day that the regular comics comes out, that we'll find out what the cover for this looks like. But they are on his web store as an exclusive, and they do tend to sell out pretty sharpish. And yeah, and I only know that exists because it's in the credits page as the final cover being listed. Great Clayton Crane.
Mark from the future here, bringing you news that the Clayton Crane exclusive is of Serpentor. Three Serpentils in one, almost full figure, with a headshot behind, and then Serpentor on his air chariot. This exclusive cover will likely go live on Clayton Crane's website the Saturday after release, which would make that Saturday the 23rd. But at the time of this recording, I don't have a formal announcement of that either. So look out. It'll sell quick if previous drops are anything to go by. Back to Mark in the present. Oh, doesn't he sound young?
Plot breakdown.
On the roof of Springfield Community Center, Cobra uncovers evidence of Serpentor Khan's cyborg spies. Elsewhere, in Springfield, in the attic of Dawn's parents' house, Dawn makes her report back to the pit, noting that she has discovered a weakness. There is a self-destruct mechanism within Cobra's new cyborgs. Dawn's parents' neighbor, a Crimson Guardsman, comes snooping around, and he is knocked out by Dawn's parents. In the pit, the forensics team are examining the cyborgs from Snake Eye's cabin. And one of the inactive cyborg's hands comes to life. The handroid is shot by Stalker. In a Quonset hut above the pit, Spirit, Lady J, and Multo take down the three Vipers that were snooping around, and they prevent them from detonating a nerve gas grenade. At the Revanche facility in Baton Rouge, a Python officer is helping Serpentor keep under wraps that they are installing chips that nullify Revanche control. And at Castle Destro in Scotland, Destro and Baroness toast with Zartan to their new alliance. However, this Zartan is a simulacrum working for Serpentor. Elsewhere, the real Zartan is being targeted with a missile.
To be continued.
Tim, top down. I feel like we've talked a lot about art previously, and you've had kind of mixed feelings towards that of Chris Mooneyham. So I'd be interested to see how you feel about this issue more generally, and maybe if you could talk about that point that we discussed about kind of your feeling about your high level takeaway from how you feel around Chris's art.
Yeah, I don't want anyone to think that I don't like Chris Mooneyham's art. I love Chris Mooneyham's art. I think the styles that he seems to be alluding to in how he draws, and one of the letters in the letters page even points it out. A fantastic blend of Kubert, Sienkiewicz, and Sean Gordon Murphy, right? And I would throw in Jordi Brené. He draws really well. I love the grit. I love the texture. I love the shadows. I would be okay with 20% less shadows because I just love seeing color on G.I. Joe and Cobra costumes and vehicles. Mooneyham draws great faces and eyes and textures, you know, and okay. So where I think his work could be a little stronger is storytelling and how he actually breaks down a page and picks his, quote, camera angles. And in the first three issues of this new run, I thought that there was a certain kind of repetitive shot where we kept seeing people straight on and close-ups of faces straight on. And in and of itself, there's nothing wrong with that, but it started to feel like it was at the expense of pulling the camera back and showing more of the environment, or pulling the camera back and moving the camera like 5 or 10 feet to the left or right and showing the room at some kind of diagonal. Issue 304, and I sent an email to Postbox the Pit after 303 saying this and saying, I sure wish Mooneyham's layouts were a little different. And I even went as far as suggesting that perhaps the person who writes the comic, who's very good at laying out comics, could lay out this comic. 304, there were some improvements. I saw much less of the sort of straight on and straight on close up at the expense of some environmental exploration. And 305 somewhat continues that. There are a couple panels where I feel like we're looking at something straight on and I'd like a little more variety. But I am so thrilled that Skybound has found this artist to draw G.I. Joe. People online and in the letters page seem to really like his work. I have a friend who sees the same, what I would consider a limitation in the storytelling, and it sort of also jumps out at this friend. But I totally understand that maybe I'm the only person who sees this as any kind of weakness. And, you know, if Mooneyham drew this book forever, I would be very excited. So this is not like this guy's got to go. It's I see an area for improvement.
Mm-hmm.
And if my letter shows up in print in the next issue, it's going to come across, I think, as really negative and damning. And I think hopefully if it shows up and everyone reads it, it's sort of seen in the context of this guy's great. I think there is improvement.
Mm. I think that's it's useful perspective to see, because sometimes you can see something and you can see just the bit, you know, you can see it, you think it's great, but you can see kind of the bit that you think would just make it that much greater, whereas sometimes you see something and you just think it's rotten and you're like, where to begin? You know, I can't pinpoint a single thing because everything's wrong with this, you know. But there we go. I'm just sort of flick forward to page one, and I was noting to myself that we've got a page one splash page here, and this is actually the first single image splash page that we've got on a page one of the five issues. I was just flicking back to the previous four, and while page ones have been splashy, they have been multi-panel. So it's a return of a single page opening splash to the G.I. Joe page one. If only there'd also been a story a story title in lettering in bold, you know, big letters and creator credits on that page, I'd be in heaven.
And there's space for it with the stars and stripes, yeah, motif on the top and bottom, but you know, that's not how comics are designed these days, so that's okay. going back to this critique of Mooneyham tending to draw straight on with 1-point perspective and avoiding 2-point linear perspective and 3-point linear perspective. Hey, this splash page on page one of issue 305 is in 3-point perspective. If you look at the up and down lines of all this air conditioning stuff, you can see that it starts to like make a triangle that converges down like 2 feet below the bottom of the page. Anyway, so you know, this is the
and
kind of page.
We've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 characters on this page, all full figure, seeing you know, an awful lot of their outfits and not a single close up in sight on this page.
Yeah, because I nitpick. All right, here's my nitpick. I want to see some red on that Viper in the middle.
Mm.
I love the 86 Viper color combination. The black vest, the red ribbing and details, the blue cloth. And certainly there have been some action figure variations over the years where there's a Viper that's just all blue and a different kind of blue. So maybe it's that guy. The Toys R Us 3-pack from 98?
It's curious that they've gone for this, you know, all blue color on there. And you wonder to what extent it's a proactive design choice.
I think I'm not trying to read the mind of the talented Francesco Segala, but I think there may be, with a book as complicated as G.I. Joe, there are all these bits to color. In the same way that an artist may slightly simplify a costume, putting something in shadow, leaving out a few details, you know, like three straps become one strap, or a bunch of ribbing just becomes a little bit of pants on the leg. I think there is sometimes a color decision to color the, I don't mean bright and dark highlights, I mean the sort of vital highlights and leave out some of the details. And there is a desaturated approach to all of these colors, right? These blues are not like bright, bright emerald blue. They've got a little gray in them. They've got a little red. They've got a little brown in them. You know, there's a little beige. If you squint, this page is all kind of blue beigey. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, maybe, anyway, it's a neat first page. And I'm struck on the next two pages by the shape of the eye slits in Cobra Commander's new mask.
Mm.
The sort of cat's eye. If a person's wearing glasses when they're shaped like this, I think that's how you describe them.
Or a comic person might describe them as Spider-Man eyes, or possibly Catwoman eyes, depending on the
design. And I'm struck by what a neat little detail that Mooneyham puts in here to A, make this Cobra Commander look more nefarious, as opposed to the sort of regular shape of the eye slits of the old hooded costume. You know, again, thinking back to Ron Wagner's cover to G.I. Joe number 100, you know, mm-hmm. Cobra Commander on that cover doesn't look particularly evil. He's not like frowning and leaning forward and there's all these shadows on his eyes and his eye slits are sort of echoing the evil quality. It's just, but here, this Cobra Commander looks intimidating.
Yeah, it's almost got kind of the squiggle of if you were to draw a cartoon villain, that sort of the squiggle of an evil eyebrow. It's almost taking that shape to some degree, isn't it? And so they're in the beginning of the story, we're opening with an investigation as to those disintegrated Vipers that Dawn had encountered in the previous issue. And they're sort of putting together figuring out exactly what had happened via the, you know, what's been left behind on those smoldering embers and the video footage and the scraps that they're finding. And they're seeing the shadows that Cobra Commander can spot, the silhouette of the shadows as being Cobra Vipers. And I laughed to myself, but then no prized it, because the Telly Viper says that he corrects Cobra Commander from who's looking at the shadows. He says, "Those are Cobra Vipers, modified Cobra Vipers. Looks like they're altered with Revanche technology." And I thought to myself, hey, you can tell that from a shadow? That's very clever. But I guess the no plies there is that actually he's putting two and two together, the pieces, the remnants that have been left behind in conjunction with the shadows on the image, and I guess also the surveillance footage of Cobra Island, that they're able to put all those pieces together and you know, realize that they're dealing with these modified Cobra Vipers altered with Revanche technology snooping about on their rooftops. And of course, it means Serpent or Khan and that tooth yanker, Dr. Mindbender.
On these two pages, I'm struck by these three pages, all the forensic work. That's fun. This is not a conversation I feel like we've seen Larry Hama's Cobra Commander have before or in a long time. And it just feels different, the way that he's feeling defensive of Springfield. And I'm really struck by, on pages 2 and 3, the sort of bookending of the close-up panel of Cobra Commander with the white background and the close-up of Cobra Commander with the red background, where colorist Francesco Segala feels very confident in working with a limited palette. And G.I. Joe Comics at IDW didn't have this approach. And there's several things going on here. It is the desaturated palette. You know, these are not like bright, reflective blues. All the blues don't look like satin and silk. There are textures. You know, if you look at the sky in the big panel on page 3, where you can see the Springfield Community Center, but just tiny silhouettes on the roof, that sky, I don't mean the black ink of the texture. I mean the actual sort of ink wash of the sort of grayish night sky. But then, you know, and this has happened a couple times in each issue where a panel just has a bright white background when someone is reacting, you know, when Duke and Wild Bill are trying to, you know, pull up on the yoke of the airplane, or whatever it is. And it is a classic and highly effective device. You know, white for surprise, red for anger, sometimes yellow for surprise. And it's both neat, and it also adds some real variety to the pages. And one of my comments on the colors in the IDW run was scenes tended to sort of, in terms of color scripting, run together because the approach was almost always the same for every scene. And then there's something subtle, which I've referred to in previous issues, that Sagala keeps doing in this issue, where he tends to use a certain color cast depending on where we are. So you turn to page 4 and Dawn's in an attic, and the boxes and the rafters around her are slightly warm. There's a little bit of red in that sort of pale gray color. And then below her, back in the pit, Duke, although he's illuminated by this giant screen, this table, the cast for that scene in the background is purple. And so on this page, you have this color. And then on the next page, right, the exterior of Dawn's house, what's the color cast? It's aqua. The van is aqua. The houses, the grass, the bushes have some aqua. In that middle panel where we see Dawn looking out the window and her reflection, great panel, aqua. It is a desaturated, sort of faded aqua, right? And then on that panel at the bottom of page 5, where the Crimson Guardsman is at the door and Dawn's parents are in the door, it's really subtle, but what's the color inside their house? It's a yellow. Right? So you have these colors that reinforce scene changes, which is great.
Yeah, I'll just sort of rewind slightly to something that you touched on when you were talking about Cobra Commander and sort of this putting together of the piece where he's being quite hands-on in looking at, you know, what's happened on the roof of the Springfield Community Center here. And just across these 5 issues, Cobra Commander is being presented as being a lot of things, you know. He's more directly sort of violent in terms of shooting Wade Collins in 301 and then making the escape from the Joes, and just more calculated, more of a leader in terms of the couple of rallies that he's been having with the large audiences, and a bit more sort of clued together about sort of the defense that he's leading on, and then this investigation here is just sort of a bit more clever, shrewd. He's being presented as a lot more of a sort of a credible leader and threat, and less of the kind of the cartoon silliness of Cobra Commander that we have seen a fair amount of before in the towards the tail of IDW.
As a contrast, one of my notes for this issue is, although Duke and the couple of Joes with him in the pit are directing other Joes and making decisions, and although Dr. Mindbender and Serpentarchon are directing other people and watching, you know, remote video and making decisions, there is a little passivity now, 2 or 3 issues in a row, where, you know, Duke sure is just standing around at base a lot.
Yes.
And Dr. Mindbender and Serpentarchon are just standing around at base a lot. And I certainly understand in military and paramilitary hierarchies, you have someone back at base making decisions. And then you cut to a robot hand attacking some Joes, and then someone shoots it. Or some Joes grab the 3 zombie vipers. And there's a sort of punch of action and activity. So I understand the logic behind it. But my 2 comments would be, you know, I don't want these favorite characters who are really smart and exciting to be standing in front of monitors making decisions for too many more issues before they do something. And also, the doing something could be pretty small. I don't need necessarily Duke to go on a mission into the field, and I certainly think we'll see Serpentarchon in the field soon. But, you know, they could be sort of walking through the room, pushing buttons, flipping through paperwork in a folder and a clipboard, handing a tablet to an underling. I think about when I got out of college, I worked on a TV show, And every episode had sort of the main kid talking with a teacher. And this was an animated show. And the scenes were really funny because the actors were great and the voices were interesting and the writing was great. But the director sort of pointed out that it's like, well, we can't have like a 2-minute scene every episode where these two characters just like sit like outside of school on the soccer field and just like talk. They have to be doing something. Give them something to do. And I remember one episode, one of the animators was showing a storyboard for one of these scenes. And one of the characters is like fiddling with something. And the animator said, "I'm having him peeling an orange." And I thought, well, that doesn't have anything to do with the scene. The scene isn't about like fruit or nutrition or like sweets or grocery shopping. They're not hungry. It's just like a prop that doesn't really distract. And it's like, sometimes when I'm reading a comic or when I'm watching a TV show and it's just a bunch of talking heads, I think, man, I wish someone were peeling an orange. And, and you know, there could be, again, a bunch of things like, you know, and certainly Stalker does do something, right? He leaves that scene and he does something. But I feel like the Serpentor Khan and Dr. Mindbender talking back and forth to each other about what's happening and what they're going to do next. I want a prop. I want some visual interest. I want them like walking down a hallway or going through a doorway or, you know, like Dr. Mindbender like picking at a weird boil because he's a zombie.
Yeah, nasty.
You know, and it's sort of like, they're zombies, right? Like that hasn't come up.
Yeah, not.
They're not acting like zombies. So
yeah, they sort of the bit that they're emphasizing is that they're not acting like zombies too much most of the time. Well done for holding it back. Your example sort of put me in mind a little bit of Watchmen, when Rorschach is turning up at the Night Owl's house and he's sat there at this kitchen table and he's eating cold baked beans out of a can, and you know it's not essential to the plot or anything, but it's just he's doing something, and at the same time it's this kind of thing that's talking to him as a character and his, you know, his traits, and while that bit isn't necessarily advancing the plot, it's informing the type of, you know, character that he is and making for an interesting visual.
Yeah, you know, the other thing that this reminds me of is a lot of really great dialogue over 10 years at Marvel Comics, reading various Brian Michael Bendis written Avengers, Daredevil, or Spider-Man comics. Great dialogue. Sometimes I'm aware, it's like, all right, this is like the third page in a row of two characters having a conversation, and the dialogue's really snappy. I'm like, what are they doing?
A lot of talking heads in that era.
Yeah, someone standing at the window looking outside Avengers Tower or Stark Tower, and someone else is behind them sitting, and it's witty. But, you know, could someone be fixing some Iron Man armor? You know, or could someone be like flipping through a manila folder because they're about to go on a mission and they're briefing themselves? Anyway, okay, so back to the issue. I want to call out something really subtle that I don't think I noticed in previous issues. If you look at page 4... the big panel on the bottom. Oh, hey, it's a straight on 1-point perspective shot looking at a couple of Joes.
I think it's allowable. They're looking into the monitor. So we're kind of seeing them from almost the monitor's POV.
I do think it's allowed. This issue does have a couple 3-point perspective panels, which I don't think I have seen much of in Mooneyham's G.I. Joe. And the 1-point straight on shots, there's just a few of them. It's not past my like, you know, like red alert too many limitation. But I do notice them. But this panel, when Duke says, obviously you emerged victorious from that encounter, look at that word balloon, and then look at the one below it. Were you able to collect any intel? These ellipses, these ovals in Pratt Brousseau's lettering, are not perfectly symmetrical. I think he might be drawing them by hand in the computer, maybe tracing on top of a perfectly drawn ellipse. And it's subtle. It's great because it is slightly irregular. And in the era of perfect computer lettering and perfect computer word balloons, and perfect straight lines for panel borders, or if an artist is using a certain tool in the computer, just any perfect straight line, you know, for a brick or a building or a, whatever it is, this little bit of irregularity adds back in the human touch that this was made by hand, even with digital tools. And the like too perfect, too clean, too crisp thing of comics in the last 20 or 30 years, anything that sort of pushes back against it, I find delightful.
Very good. So this is the sequence in Dawn's house where she's up in the attic or loft and you know, reporting back to the pit, and then she's able to spy this Fred Series neighbor who looks like he's got brown hair, but you know, I'm not going to quibble too much about
I am
and he's, you know, knocking on the door to you know, ask if Dawn might be there, get a little bit of credit for making the discovery. And Dawn's parents, you know, let him in. We're initially a little bit worried, you know, are they going to turn on Dawn? But of course they don't, and they, you know, duff him up and reassure Dawn, let him know that they're not going to kill their neighbor, but they'll keep him tied up, and then they'll slip out of town tomorrow, so that to let Dawn make her way, and then they'll follow. And they also give Dawn a cute nickname as well. They say, "We love you, Nina."
This page has that two panels before the one you just referred to with the nickname. It's an over-the-shoulder shot. We're up on the stairs with Dawn looking down past her at her parents and the Fred on the floor. And hey, it's three-point perspective. And similarly on the previous page, when we're looking up at Dawn, when she's on the landing looking down, it's the panel under her parents looking at each other when the word balloon says, "You didn't mention this to anyone else, did you, Fred?" Right, Dawn's got her hands on the railing. We are looking slightly up at her. So I'm seeing a lot more panel variety in the quote camera placements. And I don't feel like this issue is sort of stale or limited in its visual storytelling, as was my critique for 301, 302, 303, except for one scene, which I will point out in a moment. I do just want to remind everyone, when Wade Collins shows up on the first page of issue 43, he's got red hair. It's a light orange. And when Mark Bright drew some Freds around issue 98, 101, some CGs have their helmets off. They've got red, you know, I say red hair. I mean light orange, like Irish people. And in the IDW run or later in the Marvel run, I think all the Freds sort of became blonde, like yellow. And here, the Chris Mooneyham inking is suggesting darker hair. But the panel where the Fred is unconscious on the floor, he does seem to have not brown hair, but, you know, light orange hair, red hair. So the jury's still out, but my vote for any colorists or editors listening is to go back to how Wade Collins and his ilk looked at the beginning appearances in the Marvel run.
Mm-hmm. So then next sequence is in the pit where they're doing this forensic examination of one of these cyborgs that they'd taken from Snake Eyes' cabin in the High Sierras and had that altercation midair last issue where they realized that they weren't completely inactive, but they don't seem to have quite learned that lesson, because we've got a hand which is able to reactivate. So I had a bit of an eye spy, Tim, which sort of flummoxed me for a couple of minutes thinking about who is this character, it should have been quicker for me, because I think we've been given enough information that I should have realized who it was. But to the right of that cyborg laid out on the table, did you immediately realize who that character on the right is, with the kind of orange looking top and grayish looking buckles.
That's airtight because he was with these characters in the previous issue, right? Although now that you're saying this, is it Lightfoot? Because he's really got Lightfoot's costume. Wait a minute. What's going on?
It's gotta be my airtight. Realization was, yes, of course it's airtight, isn't it? That he was with them in the previous issue, and you know, it's that same team back together again, Mainframe, Black Hat, Airtight. They were on the Tomahawk together, so it's the same team, obviously. But the color scheme for Airtight did throw me ever so slightly. I was like, is that Sky Striker, the Tiger Rat pilot? What would he be doing there? It took me a little bit longer than really it should have to figure out, oh, of course it's blooming Airtight, isn't it?
I think what might be throwing us off is that Airtight's costume is an orangey yellow and green. And here, this guy, all of his chest stuff, the stuff on top of his yellow orange jumpsuit, is more of a blue gray. And yes, that sounds very nitpicky, but you know, it's a toy line, and there's all this variety in it, and you know, one small change and it's a different action figure. I think I was also slightly responding to his receding hairline. And of course, we don't, I don't know about the classified action figure, but in the original figure, his helmet is molded on. But when Airtight shows up in the Funhouse, which is a great 1985 episode, he has his helmet off. And the way that Russ Heath, character designer for the cartoon, has designed him, he has a, like Duke, like the original Duke before his like buzz cut, he has a little bit of a receding hairline. Anyway, okay, so
a little bit Norman Osborn-y, perhaps.
Yeah, not with the ridges in the hair, but the actual sort of hair pattern. Okay, something that's great on these two panels, and something that I would like Mooneyham to do differently. All right, so something that's great in the big panel on the left page, with Airtight and the other two Joes looking down at this operating table. There's something really subtle, which is there are three or four or five black circles around the panel, which are lights that Mooneyham has knocked out in black silhouette. And then Sagala in color has added sort of a white fuzzy halo around them below them. And so this is just a little subtle foreground element that adds some cool depth to this panel, right? So that we get a sense of like, how tall is the ceiling? Well, it's not too tall because here are the lights. You know, it's not a 50-foot ceiling. It's not a 30-foot ceiling. It's like a 12-foot ceiling, 15-foot ceiling. And in terms of breaking up the space, in terms of compositionally sort of echoing, paralleling the ovals of the word balloons, it's just a nice visual, right? It doesn't change the story, doesn't solve any problems. It's just a nice small decision. Okay, that's cool. The actual breaking up on the left page, how Mooneyham is not doing anything like the sort of standard, you know, 1940s through 1980s, like regular rectangular panels, you know, four panels per page, six panels per page, eight or nine panels per page. There's a lot of variety. Mooneyham will have some, you know, wide, skinny panels and some square inset panels and like a bigger sort of anchor panel. And then the bit on the right page where the actual hand attacks Black Hat and she throws the hand across three panels. That's all very cool. Okay, so I love it. Here's my comment. In the first panel, Stalker is with Duke and Lady J, and he says, "I'm going to go tell the other team in the other room." And then in that very small second panel, over Duke's shoulder, we see Stalker in a doorway walking away from us. Great. Clear. And then we are in another space with the three Joes looking at the cyborg on the table. And then the hand attacks. And then on the right page, the hand is attacking and Black Hat throws it. And then the hand gets shot. And then there's this big dramatic two-thirds splash, and it's in three-point perspective. We are below Stalker, we are looking up at him, but we're also off axis from him, so there are all kinds of diagonals pointing to three different vanishing points on above, on the left, and on the right, way, way, way off the page. Okay. It's a very cool, dramatic, big panel, right? And it's a cool, badass moment for Stalker, both in visual and in dialogue, right? Cool, awesome. Okay. Where is Stalker? The story logic and the context clues say that he is in the same room as Black Hat Mainframe and Airtight, but I don't actually see where he is. He's in some kind of doorway, but I don't know if he's like 5 feet from Black Hat, if he's 30 feet from Black Hat. And so as much of a cool factor as there is for this page, because you get this two-thirds splash of a badass character drawn cool, doing a badass thing, I really wish the camera pulled back from Stalker 5 feet or 10 feet, and we could see something of like Black Hat's shoulder or the operating table, or like if you pulled back even further, like all three Joes and the operating table in the foreground and Stalker, and you'd see more of his body in this doorway. And I showed this to someone before we recorded, and they said, oh, he's not in the same room? Are they not all in the same room? I said, no, he left and went to a different room. And so it's clear from context and from some of the visual storytelling, I do think it could be a lot clearer. And that's part of why I've been picking on this, like Mooneyham, a lot of close-ups, a lot of straight-on shots. I feel like there could be more clarity in where his characters are in a space, in a room or in an exterior compared to other characters.
Mm. And there's a little bit of blurring of this sequence in the pit, because the first two panels are in that kind of ops room, Stalker, Lady J, Duke all together. And then the next sequence is the sort of three Joes doing the forensics post-mortem on this cyborg. And as we kind of transition between scenes, we've got the two speech bubbles that bump up against each other, that there's Duke talking
in the first room
overlapping then with the speech bubble from Mainframe. So I kind of had to stop and concentrate a little bit to realize that we're kind of moving from one room to another between these two sequences.
So this is a case where Francesco Sagala could have changed the color cast to separate these two spaces. I understand that they're all in the pit and maybe the pit wants its own color, but the room with Duke and the room with the hand, the robot hand, they could be more different from each other. And just to put a final point on this, occasionally in comics, on the last page of a story, you see the artist sign their name, or on their final issue of a run, or sometimes on like a really cool splash page, they sign their name. And it's not my thing, but you know, they drew it. And if the only place their name appears in the comic is like in typed credits on the inside front cover, the same way that an artist gets to actually sign the cover, like sure, an artist can like sign a really exciting splash page. Chris Mooneyham signs this two-thirds splash page with Stalker. And it's a cool drawing and it's a cool moment, but I do feel like that's slightly supporting my argument here that this is like, whether on purpose or not, this is a little bit more about like making a cool piece of art. Like this page is going to sell if it's an original drawn on boards, as opposed to what are the layouts and camera decisions that the story really suggests. And again, I think it's that Stalker is smaller and we see him in more of that room. And that would not be a page that, you know, like the artist would want to sign because it's not as sexy.
Mm-hmm. You made a point as well about the panel layouts, which I just wanted to echo that we definitely do get a lot of variety in the panel layouts, that on occasion there'll be a more traditional sort of six panel grid or something along those lines, like the panel where Fred gets punched in the stomach by Dawn Moreno's parents. But for the most part, we're seeing a lot of kind of like half page splashes, overlapping panels, inset panels, and a lot of variety. I like the interesting panel kind of design that they had in the sequence that we were just talking about with Stalker shooting that hand, that you've kind of got for portrait style panels of black hats grappling with the handroid and throwing it, and then it getting shot, and sort of the quick succession of the panels sort of indicating that it's all operating within a similar space, and we're almost taking like a sort of microsecond by microsecond kind of snapshot of what's happening as she's grappling with the hand, throwing it, it launching through the air, and then eventually getting shot. There is a lot of interesting variety to kind of panel layouts that we are getting here from
part of where I'm focusing so much on Mooneyham's sort of quote, it's not a movie, it's a comic, there's no camera, but his quote camera placement is that the G.I. Joe comic book, both as a comic that ran in the 80s at Marvel, when there was a particular focus on clarity because of editor-in-chief Jim Shooter, visual clarity, and also because of the Larry Hama connection, that the guy who's written this comic the whole time is a fine storyteller and pencil artist, though he has not done a lot of it that G.I. Joe readers have necessarily seen. And particularly in an unusual step, that same writer has drawn a couple issues. You know, it's not like, you know, like the guy who writes Punisher or the guy who writes X-Men, the guy who writes Batman, well, maybe that, has also drawn some issues. So in G.I. Joe, and also as G.I. Joe, a legacy Marvel book, there is a strong tradition of clear visual storytelling. And in the 90s, as the image artists, as they were starting to strut their stuff at Marvel before they left Marvel, and then really when they get to Image, what you see in that those first 3 years of Image books is a lot of pages. And, you know, everyone look at Snake Eyes Dead Game. It's like every page is an example of this, where half a page ends up kind of being a pinup or like a splash or a cover within a page. And there is less of a focus on the choreography of characters through a space, you know, if they're infiltrating a base, if they're fighting, if they're like traversing a mountain, if they're like going down an elevator and then down a hallway and getting in their tanks, and a lot of like characters standing in cool poses. And all those early Image comics are a lot of fun, but I think we mostly agree that the art was exciting and the writing was only okay. And that approach influenced all of the other publishers. So Marvel, DC, Dark Horse, other Image books that weren't from the Image founders started to have this imprint of less of the like Rod Wiggum, you know, G.I. Joe issue 40 something, like 6 or 8 rectangular panels where characters aren't like posing in awesome, like flashy Spider-Man Spawn poses, just like standing and shooting and punching and running. So here and there where Mooneyham's art gets a little more like pin-up-y and a little less like the nuts and bolts of the moment-to-moment, beat-to-beat, panel-to-panel continuity, I think like, no, G.I. Joe's not that book. It's the storytelling book.
Talking about clarity, that kind of leads me onto the next sequence there, where we're in the Quonset hut with the three Vipers and three Joes. And it's quite a different, cool sequence in that it's kind of very frenetic, up close, physical kind of grappling and jeopardy that the likes of we don't necessarily get a huge amount of all the time, particularly in non-ninja characters. And I do like the sequence, but there was a moment of clarity that sort of slightly confused me, which I kind of, again, have to go back on just to make sure that I'm following it correctly. I think it's caused by two Vipers being kind of identical designs involved in this battle at the same time. And what happens is that Lady J is fighting against one of them and Spirit is fighting against the other. And Spirit elbows one of them in its visor and smashes the visor. And at the same time, Lady J is fighting with hers and he's also got a smashed visor, perhaps from a headbutt. So we've got kind of two Vipers with visors smashed in this sequence simultaneously, who I think are different characters, but it sort of slightly makes for a more confusing interaction. Funny enough, though, Spirit's not the first time he's been involved in smashing a Viper's visor. There's a very cool panel back around issue 100-ish in Millville, where he pulls a viper by some straps against the roof of a hiss and smashes its visor, which is a particularly satisfying panel.
I think part of the storytelling vagueness around these two Joes and these two vipers you're pointing to is that the actual page with the elbow to the visor and the headbutt, all the backgrounds drop out. And on the previous page, halfway through, the backgrounds drop out. And this is a complicated scene because it takes place both on ground level inside the Quonset hut and also one floor down in the base, on the sort of top level underground of the base. But also, if you look at the page opposite the elbow smash and the headbutt, where Spirit is, what is that, a half Nelson, a full Nelson? Where he's sort of,
it's a cool panel. Sort of
grabbing the Viper. He's in the ladder chute. And the panel, and then the panel to the left, Molto is coming out of the ladder chute up onto ground level with his machete. And the panel below the half Nelson, Lady J is on the ground, on the top underground level, wrestling with the Viper for the grenade. And so there are three good guys, three bad guys, one key prop, the grenade. Two of the bad guys look the same. Then they have this similar sort of quote injury. And it's in three distinct places, like topside in a Quonset hut, in a narrow ladder chute, and then on the top underground floor. And
let's break it down. I guess they're in the three Vipers are in the Quonset hut initially. The blanket rises up, I guess, sort of, you know, implying that there's a Joe underneath it, and one of the Vipers has disappeared.
So Spirit has taken the rear Viper down, literally down.
And then they go look at the blanket again, and they lift it up, and there's a ladder chute. And then a hand comes up to grasp the second Viper, who's still up in the room. And the gloved hand is Lady J. And so she says, "Come here, you."
Although Molto has the same glove.
True. he's got gray gloves as opposed to her kind of more brownie.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Red gloves. And then Molto arises from the ladder shaft, holding machete to fight the final Viper, who's the more sort of, you know, revanche looking Viper within the Quonset hut. And so then Spirit is grappling with his first Viper that he had grabbed. Lady J is grappling with the second Viper that she had grabbed, and he's the one with the grenade and pulling the pin. So Spirit takes out his visor, Spirit takes out his Viper by the looks of things, and then goes to help
Lady J with hers. When Molto takes out the robot with the machete, there is no background, but they're still up in the Quonset hut.
Mm.
Okay, yeah. And then, as you were saying, Spirit takes out the visor.
Yeah, and so I think his elbow to face of that Viper is taking it out, freeing him up to then help Lady J. So presumably that Viper is still alive and will be their living prisoner to interrogate. And then they've got the another Viper with a broken visor with the sort of the zombie-looking face underneath. And he gets a fairly brutal Marvel zombie-style shot to the head from Lady J to take him out. And then this element of Molto chopping off his hand to regain that pin, which has been frozen into place.
I had
a thought, which we've not done this for a little while, but this sequence really, for me, is a bit of a Hammer Time hammerism.
Oh, yeah.
Stop! Hammer Time!
Time to beat the soles of your boots with my face. Sucking chest wounds, red ninjas, brain scanners, rubber hoses, blue ninjas. And then some more sucking chest wounds. Hammer Time!
And that is this real kind of choreography and focus on this very specific technical detail about the grenade pin and the grenade spoon as to how they are sort of functioning as kind of mechanical components of this weapon.
Yeah, and it starts 2 pages earlier when the Viper says, we'll have to check them again. Irk, getting this pin back in is a pain, right? That Viper is letting us know
right.
that the this scene has both Chekhov's grenade and also Chekhov's machete, because in a straight-on shot with one-point perspective, Spirit and Lady J and Molto are walking down a hallway at us. Molto has his machete, and I thought, oh, I don't remember what Molto's particular weapons are. Cool, I guess he has a giant knife. I wonder if he's going to use that. And then a couple panels below, this Viper is like, hey, Tim, I'm doing something very specific with a grenade. I'm disarming it. I'm putting it back into inactivity. And I thought, I think someone's going to mention this grenade again, this issue. Right? It's like, well, it's not on the cover to the next issue, so I bet it's wrapped up in this issue. And then the grenade doesn't go off, but they spend 2 pages worrying about it and talking about it, two and a half pages. And yeah. the machete does, quote, go off. And this scene is also, so it's both that thing you just said, where Larry Hama is being very specific about a very specific kind of material. You know, like, there was an Army Navy surplus store in my town growing up, and my brother and I each bought, when we were, you know, like sixth and ninth grade, a grenade, a disarmed Army surplus grenade. And it's heavy and it's got a pin, and I'd never pulled the pin out, but I've started to tug it a few times, and that's a different kind of grenade than the one in this scene. But something that, like, I didn't quite realize when I saw Big Lob use a grenade in the animated G.I. Joe the movie, and, you know, like, military shows and movies as a kid, pulling the pin of a grenade, it's not like a hot knife through butter. There's some friction, there's some tension, you know? It's like dragging a little piece of metal. Anyway, and so here's a very different kind of grenade. And so, okay, so Hama's actually pointing out to all of us this very specific material works in a very specific way. You know, it's like in some comics or movies, someone just reloads their weapon, their pistol, right? And in a Larry Hama G.I. Joe comic, someone might say something like, oh, the so-and-so's jammed, or like, no, the so-and-so clip doesn't fit in the so-and-so pistol. I need the different so-and-so clip, right? Like, no, throw me your other clip. That's the 5, not the 6, right? Like, Hama's thinking about that. Okay, and then, so it's the actual material. And then it's the specific concern of what happens when this weapon goes off, right? Because it's a, what kind of grenade is it?
It's a nerve gas ordnance. I had an observation that it looks a lot like a standard Mark II pineapple style grenade, which was prevalent during World War II. But yeah, the MacGuffin is that it's got nerve gas in it.
So Hama may have provided an image for Mooneyham. Mooneyham may have Googled something on his own. Hama may be sort of inventing or exaggerating a specific weapon. Mooneyham may be exaggerating or inventing a specific look. But when G.I. Joe Comics and also The Nom, which was a Marvel book that Larry Hama was consulting editor on, have occasionally referred to chemical weapons like Agent Orange or White Phosphorus, it is a thing to be avoided. And
yep.
And in this G.I. Joe series, a zombie bomb already went off, and Airtight is already in this issue in a different scene, although very close by. And so, you know, this kind of grenade weapon has a different resonance than, quote, just a machine gun or a missile or a rocket from a plane or a pistol. And so there's a different level of worry. And so even though I found on that page with the elbow and the headbutt, even though I found Spirit's dialogue, not if I clamp my hands around yours to prevent the spoon flying, I felt like that was a little overwritten for my benefit. I feel like Spirit clamping his hands around the Viper's hand could visually sell that idea without... because in the moment, you wouldn't say it. You know, it's like, Mark, as we podcast, make sure that your face is 3 inches and 45 degrees from your microphone and your headphones are plugged in. It's like, no, we're doing a podcast, you know.
Yeah, it's a tricky one, isn't it? Because it's a sequence designed all about the very technical specifics of how the pin and the spoon of this grenade work in combination together. And how do you explain that in a succinct way without looking like you're over-explaining?
But I do think that a little less dialogue here would work. Or, you know, okay, this big panel on the bottom of Spirit clamping his hands down on the Viper's hand and the grenade. What if that were two panels? What if the first panel were what we're seeing here, but sort of cropped a little bit so that it's just the two heads and their like hands, and then we have a close up of Spirit's hands really tightly holding, and a little bit of different dialogue, like Lady J, the spoon, hurry. You know, I feel like you could slightly under-explain it in the dialogue, and from context, we would get it. And maybe the counter is like, Tim, you just got very particular about how many feet Stalker is in a doorway from the other Joes when he fires his gun. And here, like, Hama and Mooneyham are, like, working extra hard to make it clear. And I feel like this sequence here in some ways overdoes it and in some ways slightly underdoes it. And then the third thing that really strikes me about this scene, one, is the like very specific weapon, the mechanics of it. Two, the sort of concern about that weapon different than other weapons. And three, this scene is funny. And I think we sometimes forget that Larry Hama like is a funny guy with a sense of humor, and he writes funny bits into G.I. Joe. And it's like, how does this scene end, right? With Molto cracking a little bit of a joke as a tension break for the characters in the scene and for us. And similarly, when Lady J shows up and shoots the friggin' cyborg zombie monster in the point blank, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 times with a pistol, I think that's Hama like chuckling.
Because, yeah, he says, "You're not going to unlock my fingers from the pin. We'll see about that."
Right. And in the same way that Stalker, you know, Stalker's line a couple pages earlier, mm-hmm. when he shoots the hand, like that line is both a badass Stalker cool thing. It's also Hama saying like, man, this is fun. I think readers see that line and it's both Stalker being cool and also like, ha ha ha. And so, you know, in the same way that on the next page, after the grenade scene finishes, when Mindbender and Serpenter Khan are talking, and is it Dickens who wrote?
Steinbeck. Serpentor says, "We all know what happens to the best laid plans of mice and men once the first shot is fired," and that is from Robert Burns. "The best laid schemes of mice and men." It's, you know, saying no matter how carefully a project is planned, something may still go wrong with it. And sort of combining that again with kind of the view that I guess military plans go out of the window once the first shot is fired in a battle.
Right. You know, sometimes you read a story and you get the sense that the writer is showing off. And I don't ever get the sense when I read a Larry Hama G.I. Joe comic that Hama is showing off. I always feel like he's working for it. Like he either did the research on how a particular, you know, it's like, aim the turrets upwards. Like they're not going to hit us. Like, why not? Like we're at an angle where the turrets can't get that high. It's like, he's thinking about how the, whatever it is, the Cobra Hiss or the Cobra Maggot works. And here, when he's dropping in a historical reference, that is what Serpentor Khan would do, because he's got all these military minds, or he's Genghis Khan, a great military mind. And Hama is both commenting on, as you just said, things go out the window as soon as a military operation begins. But also you have these, you know, it's like in Star Trek when they quote Shakespeare, you know, like I think 9 out of 10 viewers like smile, and then, you know, 1 in 10 rolls their eyes. I see.
I think a few of the 10 might be oblivious as well.
Okay. All right. So four of the 10 are like, why are they talking fancy? And then maybe 1 in 10 is like, why would Klingons have Shakespeare? How did that get translated? Anyway, so I see throughout this issue, Hama inserting small bits of humor.
Mm. And back to the plot. So we've got Mindbender and Serpentor observing this going down, that the video feeds have gone dead. The three enhanced Vipers that were dispatched to Recce, the G.I. Joe HQ, have now gone incommunicado.
Another Recce, short for reconnaissance.
Incommunicado, another great $10 word from Hammer and Mindbender. But Serpentor replies, excellent, Dr. Mindbender. All is going according to plan. I don't know what that plan is.
I don't think Hama does either. I think he's going to make it up when he writes the next issue. Mm-hmm. Or he has a general sense.
I wonder what that plan will be. I do not know. Then we got another sort of different sort of scene all together. We've got a return to seeing some of these. And you talk about comedy. This is, I think, the high comedy point of the issue. The sort of pensioner casino playing mutant zombies who are being transformed into an army of cyborgs, and they're lining up for this treatment. And the zombie says, is the procedure going to hurt? I mean, hurt a lot, more than an ingrown toenail? It will be like having a root canal over your whole body. Oh, I was hoping for kidney stone level. Yeah, so yes, out and out comedy there. But and then we've got a pythonized Cobra officer who is sort of snooping about and trying to keep hidden the fact that that Serpentor and Mindbender are trying to put in their own chip to nullify revanche control. And we have a particularly interesting bit of body horror Cthulhuism type here, where the officer has his arm chopped off by one of these kind of laser swords before then kind of growing a whole bunch of gloopy Akira style
tendrils,
tendrils, appendages to kind of gloop out and crush the cyborg.
So I was totally psyched to see someone from Python Patrol. I love it when, you know, during the IDW run, sometimes in an issue there'd be a bunch of Cobra vehicles, and I don't know that it was Hama calling out three different kinds of hiss tanks in the plot, but Shannon Gallant would draw three different hiss tanks, or, you know, colorist Jay Brown would color like two of them blue and one of them black, so it's different kinds of hisses, without a toy line coming out each year that demands to be promoted in the comic book. You know, in 1989, Python Patrol toys were out, so there's this demand that the comic has to show them. And the TV commercial for the toys...
Now I will crush Tito's Tiger Force! My Python experiment will make Cobra invincible!
Python Patrol! Python Patrol! Cobra's on the attack with Python Patrol! Patrol's the evil new foe, but nobody beats G.I. Joe.
Python Patrol, vehicles and figures sold separately.
And Operation Dragonfire, the episodes in September of 85, go out of their way to explain what Python Patrol is and why. And, you know, Hama has to do the same thing, and he has, more time and space than a 30-second commercial, but maybe less time and space than a 5-part miniseries. And so, you know, he has Dr. Mindbender invent Python Patrol in part of an issue, and then you can have these vehicles and characters. And I love the color scheme of Python Patrol. I love the vehicle choices. I love the character choices. I love that Copperhead goes from being a vehicle driver to being this single pack figure. I love that, you know, if you're a kid in 89, you get a chance to own the Cobra Soldier and the Cobra Officer again. I love that the Televiper is sort of inverted, you know, now there's all this bright colors on it, like yellow, not a dark color like blue. So without this sort of demand, there is no reason randomly in 2024 to have a Python Patrol story or a Python Patrol appearance. But in the same way that in this very issue on page one, you have both Cobra Troopers and also Cobra Vipers. There is still all this variety in the hierarchy of Cobra, and either just for fun, or just to add visual differences, or just to make things clearer when you've got a group of similar looking characters, Hama's got this like tool in his toolkit. He can throw in not just a Cobra character, but a Python Patrol one. And so I'm very excited to see him. And he's a little othered in this scene, right? He's not like a normal Cobra guy. He's a subgroup. He's a sub team, right? And I feel like that subtly speaks to the fact that he's a spy. He's Mindbender and Serpentor Khan's spy. Mm-hmm. It would also work if he were a non-Python officer. So I'm happy to see him. This big two-thirds splash page where we cut to Baton Rouge, where, remind me, Mark, in a previous issue, was it mentioned that the retired people who had been at the casino in the 290s, who get hit by the zombie bomb after 301, did they get on the cruise ship and they were deposited somewhere?
I don't know how clearly it was spelt out to us, but I guess it was implied in previous sequences that part of, you know, that whole Cobra Island contingent would be involved in getting them off Cobra Island and onto the main line, and that even the pensioners could potentially be part of those forces. So
because they're the ones who are going to maybe attack Springfield.
Yeah.
I feel like, okay.
Way so, of just building out his army further beyond just the Cobra troops that were on the island.
All right. So in the previous issue, that's where Alpha 001 demoed this sort of Jack Kirby metal container that would transform a regular zombie into like an enhanced sort of Cobra revenge zombie, right?
Yeah.
All right. So now we're in this factory, this lab, and Mooneyham draws a really cool space. If you sort of look past the three word balloons that the Python officer are saying, you can see that there's sort of a spherical, it's like we're inside the Epcot dome.
Yeah, the geodesic dome.
And there's an assembly line on the left where a bunch of sort of souped up, I guess, cyborg vipers are, you know, moving down a conveyor belt as a robot arm, I don't know, zaps them or does some finishing touches. On the right side, there are at least five of these like Jack Kirby sort of column cocoon machines where you like get into this little rounded coffin as a zombie and you come out as this enhanced Serpentor Khan soldier. I do note that this is a straight on one point perspective panel, but it is a very cool depiction of a big space. This is sort of what I wish on the previous page when we see Mindbender and Serpentor Khan in sort of a nebulous control room back at the casino. But we have seen some of that space in previous issues. I do think as cool as this giant two-thirds splash is of the lab assembly line in Baton Rouge, for how big Mooneyham makes it and how many cool sort of mechanical assembly line details he packs into it, I do feel like we sort of lose the visual thread of A, zombies, because they're so small on this page and they're barely on the next page and they're like in the background and not drawn very detailed. And B, that these zombies, like just five issues ago, were like regular tourists who were just at a resort, at a beach resort. And so there's this very big person who's talking to the toenail root canal kidney stone joke. This very big person who's talking to this Python officer who's got maybe one normal arm and one sort of, you know, octopus tendril mutated arm. And I think they have a lei around their neck, the necklace of flowers.
I thought it might be the same big zombie who was on page, maybe not, it's different enough, but there was a zombie on the first page of 302 that we called out as looking quite close to the mutant leader, and they had kind of like a bit of a lei of ears.
Oh, the mutant leader from Dark Knight Returns.
Yeah,
right.
And so I wondered if it was the same character as that, but
Okay.
Perhaps not. It could just be a lay of flowers, but too far away to tell for sure.
Yeah. So, okay. So on the one hand, I love this big panel because Mooney Ham is showing this awesome giant mechanical space. And I keep saying here and there, I wish Mooney Ham would pull the camera back and show more of the room in Cobra headquarters, in the pit, in the casino, Cobra headquarters. And here he does. And now it's like, well, I also want him to move in because what does this panel want to show? It wants to show all the mechanical works, and it wants to show that there's a line of these tourists who are now zombies who are getting turned one at a time into these upgraded things. And I feel like if you push the camera in, you know, 10 feet, if you lost like the top sort of inch of this panel, you'd still get a sense of the bigness of the space. You'd still see all the mechanical stuff, but we'd be closer to the people. And you know, what happens on the next two panels? The retired person, the big retired person with the lay, keeps talking, and the camera is not on them. It's on the approaching guard, which is also an important story element. So I like this scene. I feel like since we haven't seen any of the casino vacationers turned into zombies in this issue, and, you know, if you're reading it in a graphic novel, it won't matter. But I feel like sort of as a monthly book, the visual reintroduction of the zombie tourists needed to be a little clearer, a little closer here.
Okay, and then the final sequence is in Destro's castle, sort of with the reintroduction of Zartan in two ways. Firstly, as a simulacrum, and then secondly, as the real Zartan on his swamp skier in a swamp somewhere being chased down by a missile. And this sequence feeling very familiar because I've seen a preview image of 306, where I know that this sequence continues on with the missile chasing down Zartan. So it was both new and familiar, ironically, familiarity being from the next issue.
Mark, can you remind us, in the previous issue, Destro and the Baroness get reintroduced in just a page or two?
I think it is just the very last page of 304 as a sort of segue to what is to come in the next issue. We have in Scotland a similar sort of opening panel of a castle, and it's Destro sort of sat on a throne with the Baroness by his side, and the introduction of Zartan. So it's very much a continuation of that.
Okay, so then here's another Mark I don't remember every issue question. When did we last see Zartan?
I believe it was at the end of Snake Hunt, where he was sort of helping the Joes with his team of Dreadnoughts. And then after causing a whole bunch of carnage and confusion and disarray, everyone left Springfield, Destro, Zartan, and the Joes. And I think that was it was at 275.
All right, so that's 30 issues ago. And this is funny because I remember when I was just starting to read the G.I. Joe comic, I got into it in 1989, and issue 90 is my first issue. And, you know, a year or two goes by and I love the book. And because it was only monthly and there's so many characters, sometimes a character would not be in the book for 5 issues or 10 issues, or sometimes there'd be a subplot, like the people on the landlocked freighter that's been buried, or Millville, Spirit and Mutt, where Hama comes back to it 10-30 issues later. And it has happened once again. You know, I feel like in a very broad sense, Zartan's motivation in the Larry Hama G.I. Joe comic is not what it once was, because the Hardmaster, Sobmaster, Snake Eyes, Cobra Commander, Revenge, Swordmaster mission, I think that's all sort of been taken care of. You know, like, did Zartan in 275, is there a scene where one of the Joes says, like, you can leave, or he, does Zartan say, like, I'm leaving, don't try and stop me? And so, I'm asking because I don't quite remember. But to, I have been interested, like, where is Zartan? You know, similarly with Destro, like, I'm interested in, now that Destro and the Baroness are back, you know, like, the last time we saw them, it was, you know, late in the IDW 15-year run, but Destro and the Baroness were concerned about Revanche. I don't remember anything more specific than that. And so I am looking forward to, in a general sense, Hama having another key character to sort of set up in the two-way or three-way or four-way conflict of, you know, Joe versus Cobra, or part of Cobra versus another part of Cobra. And also, what's Destro doing? Is, you know, is Destro mad at Cobra Commander for the most recent assassination attempt, most recent being a couple years ago? And sort of what the motivation will be and what the stakes will be. Because we've got a clear division between Cobra Commander and Springfield, and Mindbender and Serpentor Khan and the Cobra Island people. And we have this X factor in Zartan, which may also mean Dreadnoks. And we have this X factor in Destro and the Baroness, which may mean Iron Grenadiers, maybe not. And now they have an alliance. Except, here's the twist. This Zartan is not the real Zartan. He's a...
Simulacrum.
To use a term from the cartoon... He's a synthoid, not technically a synthoid. He's a perfect double, and Serpentor Khan and Mindbender can see out of his eyes and can hear what he's hearing. And so they have inserted this sleeper agent. And this is one of those Larry Hama things where we haven't seen Zartan in 30 issues. And literally the first thing we see of him in more than 2.5 years, in 3.5 years of real time, it's not the real Zartan. And then you turn the page and it's the real Zartan. And so now my gears start turning, like, okay, is the real Zartan going to A, go find the Dreadnoks, B, go find the Joes, C, go find Destro and the Baroness? Like, I think there's a fake me talking to you. There he is. Is the real Zartan going to track this back to Serpentor Khan and Mindbender, and he's going to head to Cobra Island? Is he going to call Cobra Commander and say, what's going on? Cobra Commander's going to say, I'm too busy. There's a guy. So I love it.
Yeah, I think they're making an enemy of Zartan where they didn't previously have an enemy. But this is a bit of a callback to issue 303, where they originally have this demonstration of the Garland surgical bot that we see again in the previous scene. And Serpentor asks, by the way, can you fabricate a lifelike shell so that the altered vipers can pass for human? So this is, I guess, where that particular thread has led, that they've created a simulacrum that can pass, not just for human, but can pass for a Zartan. And the other thought is that in the letters page, the editor notes that there's a three-way conflict between the Joes, Serpentor, and Cobra Commander. But I'd say that there's at least five ways, probably six, with Destro, Revanche, and also Zartan being introduced into the mix as well. A final high-level thought that I forgot to mention earlier was just about... And it kind of aligns to the thought that you had talking about big potential special projects that might be worked on, is that there's we're seeing this definite continuation from Hama of trying to use his new characters that he's introduced. So Black Hat and Multo, introduced towards the back end of his run at IDW, very much continuing to play a significant role in the new issues. I do wonder how long it will take before we get to see the likes of Sherlock again.
Yeah, who we haven't seen since the cover to 301. Was she in that scene where some Joes were asking about Wade Collins's
Oh, yes, she funeral? Might have been in the background there. Yes, true. There was a few of the new Joes in that sequence where where Stalker was explaining the history of Ray Collins. Good recall there, Tim.
I also just want to point out that Chris Mooneyham draws a great Zartan.
Mm.
It sort of gets the right balance for me that, you know, the cloth of his cowl and the sort of elegant simplicity of his costume, the makeup on his face, but also the shadows, which sort of enhance it, you know, whereas Mooneyham is exaggerating and changing some of the basic stuff, like a Viper costume, you know, like shoulder pads, or, you know, like some of the Revanche sort of robot characters are all invented. This looks like, you know, classic Zartan, and I like that.
And this probably is the first time that we've seen a swamp skier in the Harmaritan era, since probably it was first introduced back in the you know, issue 20s or whenever it was it first showed up.
Yes, readers, tell us we're wrong if we are forgetting it from a one particular scene in an IDW issue. And then the letters page is, once again, four whole pages. And I know in the internet era, you know, people are just blogging on their own about a comic or talking to other people on Facebook or a discussion board, and maybe not sending in an email to a letters page. I doubt many people are sending paper mail, because the post box, the pit here, doesn't even have a paper mailing address. It just has the email address. That's totally reasonable. I love the sense that it's not just me that is excited about this comic. It's these other five or six people who the editor has picked their correspondence to reproduce. And there's a little bit of a variety in the letters. It's all positive. I'm surprised and pleasantly surprised. You know, I sort of keep waiting for someone, just because, you know, it's the world and there's a lot of variety, someone to say, like, well, I like this better from 5 years ago. Or, you know, this new run is good, but it's not quite doing what I want. So I'm sort of delighted that, you know, the letters, they're all, it's a variety of people who are fans all the way from the beginning, fans from maybe the middle of the Marvel run, fans from more recently. People are excited about Hama. People are excited that Hama's doing good work. People are excited about Mooneyham. Two people are questioning about reprints. One person gets really specific, and the answer is sort of properly vague. It's like, we know, we're thinking about it. Actually, I guess three of the letters ask about reprints. Letter writer Gene Kendall says something great about color artist Francesco Segala. Says, the colors have retro elements, but that wouldn't seem to be the appropriate word. More accurately, the colorist appreciates the new unique textures that classic comics coloring techniques provide and embraces them with no shame. So many comics today suffer from inappropriate color palettes. Why is everything blue and purple now? Or generic colors with no depth, texture, or personality. Francesco Segala's work is still modern, but manages to also embrace what worked so well for so many decades. I agree. I also think the comment about blue and purple, I think this letter writer is referring to this very popular style from the last 10 years that I think, like, two colorists at Marvel really, really pushed, and a lot of people followed along, where foreground elements are knocked out in purple. And if you're wondering what I mean, just look at the cover to Marvel Comics Blood Hunt number 2, where there are some Avengers on a roof ledge, and the way that they pop is that the buildings behind them are like orange and red, and then all of the vampires coming up at them on the bottom are knocked out in light purple. I think that might be what this letterer is referring to.
The other theme that I noticed from the letters is that we're getting a lot of returning readers who've you know, lapsed potentially for quite some time and are coming back, sort of attracted by the relaunch at Skybound, which is obviously very much what they were hoping for. But the other thing is there was a lot of letters still being run from 301. So I guess in terms of, like, the volume of letters coming in for 301 as the first issue, probably much higher than other issues. So trying to want to touch on those and represent some of those different voices and opinions. But also, I guess, as in terms of editorial, it must be easier to just grab some of those ones that you've got in first and sort of space those out, because you can get ahead of yourselves a little bit more. But hopefully we'll get some more content related to the more recent issues in subsequent issues.
Yeah, I think there was yet one more letter which said sort of lightly, I didn't like the book at IDW. Or, I didn't like the book as much at IDW, and this is a real improvement.
It's a Larry Hammer colloquialism. He's talking G.I. Joe and all its heroism. Can you guess what it is? Is it something new? Now listen as Larry drops a slice of real life on you!
Before we wrap up, I had a couple of colloquialisms. We talked about it quite a lot, Quonset huts, but what is a Quonset hut? It is a lightweight prefabricated structure of corrugated galvanized steel with a semi-cylindrical cross section. The first Quonset huts were made in 1941 for the US Navy. They needed a building that could be used for many different purposes. At the same time, it had to be light and easy to ship. It had to be possible to put it together without skilled workers. The word Quonset is derived from an Algonquin word which roughly translates to small, long place. There was a nice use of the word acetylochloronistic case blockers in the sequence with the Vipers, where he says, even with my helmet integrity compromised, my mods will allow me to survive the release of the acetylia consequenta blockers. Say that with a mid-battle, please. So I think what he's saying is that the nerve gas would be having these impacts on the Joes, stopping the blood cells from transmitting signals around their body, whatever the science is, and that his mods would protect him from that. The other one I noticed was Destro saying Slanchevar. That's the looks like it's written Slainte Mahath. That's Gaelic for good health, or you might say cheers. And then he says subsequently Sassenach, which is again Gaelic for an English person. It's considered derogatory, and it's derived from the Scottish Gaelic word for Sassenach, meaning Saxon, so the non-Gaelic Scottish lowlanders.
I think a quick response to that. I wonder if Hama's tipping his hand here, that Destro might suspect this isn't the real Zartan, that the real Zartan would know what that means and wouldn't need the Baroness to translate. Also, I have one final top-down comment, which I forgot to make earlier. Can I make it now?
Go for it, yeah.
Page 7, Dawn's dad, after knocking out the Fred, says, "We can't kill him. He's our neighbor. We'll keep him tied up and we'll slip out of town tomorrow." And I read this comic right after I read Cobra Commander number 3. And there has been some violence in Cobra Commander 1 and 2, and there is more violence in Cobra Commander 3. And I thought, what a contrast. Here are two G.I. Joe books. They're both rated T for teen. And not that Joshua Williamson in the Energon universe is cynical or dark, he's writing a book that has been pitched as a horror comic, and here is Hama writing in it's just very different.
Yeah,
I'm not saying that Hama doesn't use blood, and I'm not saying that Joshua Williamson only shows a lot of blood, but what different takes to captives than in these two G.I. Joe comics.
You can tie him up, and in one issue, one book, you can do one thing. In another book, you can do another, for sure. Yes, so I think that is us done with G.I. Joe 305. We will be back to cover 306 when that is out. It's a skip month, so 306 returns. It is 306 returns in May, but we will be back to talk Cobra Commander issue 2 and 3 very soon, with Cobra Commander issue 3 coming out the same day as issue 305 of ARAR. We'll also be looking back at the Devil's Due era and talking to some creators along the way. If you want to find out more about Talking Joe, you can visit talkingjoe.co.uk, which is the website. You can visit our Facebook group and get involved in the discussion. You can follow us on Twitter or on Instagram, and you can contact us via the website and even leave us a voicemail for inclusion in a future episode. And we're also on YouTube. All of our episodes are getting published either as video episodes or just audio only episodes on the podcast playlist on our YouTube channel. So another place to find us, and a good place to leave us a message about how great you think Talking Joe is. It's always nice to hear. We're also on Patreon, patreon.com/talkingjoe. A big thanks to our backers: Richard, Sam, Jay, Bill, Christopher, Justin, Rob, Brian, Shane, Ryan, Simon, and Chris, who are all getting early access to episodes as well as some exclusive content. Tim, where can people hear from you when you're not talking to me?
I'm writing the foreword to the After Action Report, the making of Silent Interlude. So that'll be in print this spring or summer. I own a comic book store in Somerville, Massachusetts. That's Hub Comics. I have a social media channel on YouTube where my creative partners and I release video essays on TV and film. And I write about G.I. Joe at my blog, arealamericanbook.com.
Very good. So that is us done, but remember that
nobody beats Talking Joe. Oh wait, the other one. Nobody beats Talking Joe, an international podcast.
Laters.